This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are you ready for climate change? Ready or not, it's here. Maybe you were dreaming of leaving the city for a more sustainable life. We'll talk with our Radio EcoShock correspondent, Jerry Williams, about her adventure leaving Washington, D.C. She headed for the Midwest. What does it take to really get out of town? We'll also touch base with Carolyn Baker from her home in Boulder, Colorado. That's the scene of the latest amazing extreme rainfall event. Last year it was fire, this year floods. But first we'll learn how to grow food in a hotter and drier world.
Radio EcoShock.
How can we feed ourselves as the climate becomes unstable? Let's find out more with Gary P. Nabin. Gary is a research scientist at the Southwest Center at the University of Arizona. He's the author of the new book, Growing Food in a Hotter, Drier Land, Lessons from Desert Farmers in Adapting to Climate Uncertainty. Gary, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be with you and your listeners.
I'm sorry we missed one another at the Mother Earth News Fair last June, where you were a feature speaker. Could you give us just a nutshell view of what you told folks there?
Climate change won't happen to us in the future. It is already happening to us, and farmers more than anyone else probably observe the climate uncertainty being expressed all around us every day. And so what we need to do is figure out ways that the common sense that farmers and gardens have, their observational powers, help guide us into new innovations that help us adapt to climate change rather than denying its presence or thinking that the government or someone else is going to take care of the issue. To grow food in the future, we're going to have to overhaul and restructure the way we garden, farm, keep orchards, and raise livestock.
Right. Well, I'm presuming that your book about adapting to this hotter, drier world comes out of a combination of your research, your writing, but also your own practical experience. Do you want to tell us about your experimental farm?
That's right. I have a 6.5-acre farm that's largely an orchard and greenhouse and pond complex above a 60-acre farm by a nonprofit I co-founded 30 years ago, Native Seed Search. So while I don't farm on the 60 acres the nonprofit does, I actively observe what's happening there every day as I walk around and through the farm. And I've also raised sheep in northern Arizona during one of the worst droughts and wildfire years that that region near the Grand Canyon has ever faced. So I've been thinking about these issues for some time, and for over 40 years I've worked with indigenous and immigrant farmers in desert areas around the world as a technical consultant and agronomist and an educator.
Well, let's talk about the world picture. As you know, Gary, a few years ago, James Lovelock released a map of the world as it would appear in 2100. It was based on climate projections by the Tyndall Center in the UK, and there were giant bands of deserts appearing around the world in the subtropics. Southern European countries like Spain and Italy would look more like North Africa. China's deserts expanded. Do you see Arizona growing conditions becoming more prevalent in this future world?
It's not that simple, of course, in the sense that not every place is going to get hotter and drier. Sometimes the seasonality of our rainfall will shift, and that will disorient farmers for a while. So it's not exactly that you're going to have the large saguaro cactus up in British Columbia or mesquite trees in Maine. It's that all of us will be faced with climate uncertainty, and that may include catastrophic freezes and floods, heat waves, droughts, and the disruption of our rural infrastructure. So there's a variety of ways in each of the regions of the world that climate change will be expressed in its own particular context.
Well, just about a week ago, I hear the phrase that I hear so often from farmers these days. I've never seen that before. Here's a man who, in our area, British Columbia, had been farming for about 40 years, big orchards. A crazy, violent windstorm hit there. Ice was in every bit of the fruit. He lost 100% of the crop. And that's what he said. I've never seen this before. Are you hearing that too?
I hear that from so many farmers. And last year, for the Canadian Thanksgiving holiday, I was up near Victoria, and people showed me rivers that had always run into the ocean that were now dry. They had hot spells lasting longer than they were used to. And so it seems to be that the typical weather patterns are being scrambled. And some of those changes seem unidirectional. In other words, we can follow them out and, for example, say that our fruit trees will be receiving fewer chill hours most winters from now on. Other things like the floods or hailstorms or unseasonable temperature extremes, those we can't predict on a day-to-day or week-to-week or month-to-month certainty, but they're certainly going to affect many of the food producers on our continent.
Well, I know that the big issue, or one of the big issues in the Southwest, is water, and it's huge in northern India and the whole Middle East, and you've worked in the Middle East. What sort of research did you do there?
I am from a Lebanese family that traces its roots back to Oman and Yemen, so I've looked at how desert oasis farmers in Oman and to some extent Lebanon and Syria and then again in Egypt have structured farming systems that they have around desert oases to withstand extreme heat and drought. They're often drawing upon harvested rainwater or artesian spring water, but they're dealing with incredibly high temperatures, 115 to 120 degrees Fahrenheit air temperatures, and sometimes 165 degree ground temperatures. And so they found ways to grow multiple stories or strata of plants under fruit trees and date palms so that the upper tree canopies shade and buffer the annual crops and the vine crops, such as berries, from extreme heat and to some extent from extreme cold.
And I heard that the Saudis were using lots of oil to desalinate seawater and then pumping vast amounts of that into fields to grow their own wheat. And I've heard that that experiment is not going very well. Is that a sustainable path at all?
No, it's not. There's several seawater enterprises that have touted this for 30 years, and using fossil groundwater that is pumped by fossil fuel is going to increase our carbon footprint rather than decrease it. Water scarcity goes hand in hand with high energy prices, not only because we have hydroelectric power for part of what keeps the western part of the North American continent running, but also because it takes energy to pump water and it takes water to move some kinds of fossil fuels out of the ground in slurries and in other forms. So water and energy in most western states in Canada and the United States are interconnected. And so I think using one at the expense of the other is never going to work.
Well, Gary Navin, you've also sounded the alert for a long time about seeds, not just farm seeds, but plants we need to stabilize the soil and the ecosystem. What is the problem there?
The problem is that farmers are being marketed certain climate-friendly GMO crops that really can't be a solution for us. We don't want to put all our eggs in one basket. We want to get more diversity out into our fields, gardens, and orchards than ever before because that's the best bet hedging strategy that we can possibly have, not putting all our eggs in one basket. And I'm optimistic about this. If we actually develop a grassroots effort to get the 15 to 20,000 heirloom vegetable, grain, legume, and fruit varieties that are still in Canadian and U.S. nurseries and seed catalogs of small seed companies out onto the landscape, we have a citizen science effort to evaluate them for their climate adaptations and survival under different kind of extreme scenarios, it will be a far better investment than investing $40 to $180 million in the development, patenting, and licensing of a single GMO crop.
I couldn't agree more with you there, and we can all participate in that. If we get tuned in, everybody with their garden can say, well, this is what worked for me this year, and this is what didn't. Well, what about the pollinators who help us produce the fruits, the nuts, and the vegetables?
Well, I've been, again, relieved and excited and inspired by what's going on in British Columbia with setting aside field margins and green belts in some of the valleys in British Columbia for pollinators in a way that actually increases yields to the crops on the cultivated lands. So increasing pollinator diversity and trying to stabilize or enhance or restore the populations of pollinators is essential because of two factors that I think are really important for people to understand. First, that the flowering times of certain plants and the pollinator life histories or behavior itself are getting out of sync because of earlier warming in the spring, so that the pollinators may come out at a time before the flowers, or the flowers may come out before the pollinators hatch and pupate and become active. And sometimes they're now displaced or out of sync by as much as 3 weeks. It will reduce our crop yields because of lack of pollination. But the second part of this story, I think, is even more important to understand, that climate change is working in concert in sort of a pernicious way with other factors that are knocking out our pollinators, the use of neonicotinoid chemicals on farmlands. And we're finding incredible declines, not just of honeybees, the thing that you hear about in all the newspapers, but of monarch butterflies and several species of bumblebees. So pollinator diversity would be declining because of other human impacts on pollinator populations, even if there were not rapid climate change. With rapid climate change, we really need to protect our pollinators if we don't want fruitless falls and silent springs.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Gary Nabin, a researcher at the University of Arizona and author of the new book, Growing Food in a Hotter, Drier Land. Gary, I've also heard you talk about food forests, and I found that fascinating. What are they?
Well, food forest is one of those concepts that comes out of the permaculture movement. And the metaphor that they use is stacking functions within a single foodscape. As I said earlier, farmers in the desert oases of Egypt sometimes have five strata of food plants, from date palms to olive trees to peach trees to grapevines to fava beans and onions and garlic, all sharing the same vertical space and providing benefits to one another. But in a sense, it also means that food forests will lead us into a more perennial agriculture with woody tree crops as part of those food systems. We will be sequestering more carbon in the soil. Another way that we can sequester more carbon in the soil is spreading compost not only on our fields and gardens, but our rangelands and orchards, and ensuring that we're actually sequestering more carbon year after year than removing carbon from the soil.
Yeah, I think people don't realize what a big solution agriculture can be to removing carbon. It may be our best way to do it.
That's right. A couple studies have shown that of all the human activities that have impact on the planet, agriculture is the one that can shift most rapidly to sequester more carbon and reduce its carbon footprint. So what I'm saying here is that other activities like transportation and industrial processing may be slower to reduce their carbon footprints than agriculture can be. We really have the capacity to have agriculture be a positive factor in slowing global warming and potentially even reversing it in the future.
Well, another aspect that's caught my attention is the way temperature works with plants. If you get too many hot nights in the spring, that can prevent fruit setting, or that recent flash drought in the Midwest this summer reduced crop yields. How serious is the whole temperature gauge issue for growing food?
Well, it's more serious than many people have imagined, because most crops that we grow today in temperate regions have not reached their temperature thresholds until recently. If you get up above 90 degrees in the crop canopy of many dry beans like pinot beans or great northern beans, the flower aborts, the pollen becomes sterile, the pods don't set. So once we start getting up into the 100 degree temperature range as air temperatures during the day, during the flowering and fruiting season of many crops, we can expect yields to decline dramatically. And of course, in places like Arizona, we've already been facing those temperatures regularly. It's common down here to have 165 days a year over 115 to 30 days over 110 degrees Fahrenheit. But that's not necessarily, you know, the temperatures that are felt in the crop canopies. And we actually have many varieties in the desert that can even flower and fruit in those temperatures. And I think we need to propagate and have on-farm selection and backyard plant breeding to increase the number of heat-tolerant vegetable and legume crops that can be grown by gardeners and farmers. And this is possible. It doesn't mean that we should just rely on heirloom vegetables as they've been in the past. We need to be actively selecting them for a changing climate, just as farmers have for the last 10,000 years.
Well, I think some scientists are worried we could see a quick jump in temperatures, too. For example, flipping to an El Nino cycle could release more heat from the ocean, or we could get a methane burst from the Arctic. It's scary to think what could happen to our food production.
Look, I completely agree with you. The entire solution can happen on the farm. It must happen in our food system. So only 20 to 40% of our total carbon footprint is our food print, what happens before the food leaves the farm gate. The rest of it is the transportation, the microwave cooking of things that could be put in solar cookers, the packaging and the carbon in the way that we store and distribute foods. So we have to radically change our entire system of consumption, not just what happens on the farm, if we're going to avoid these rapid and catastrophic impacts of accelerating climate change.
Well, do you have a couple of quick tips for gardeners who, and just home-scale farmers who are trying to look at what they would do with hot, dry conditions, something about gray water or anything like that?
Well, again, use as much harvested rainwater and gray water as possible on perennial woody crops like fruit trees. The second thing, of course, is that any time that we build up the soil moisture-holding capacity of our soils with biochar, compost, the inoculation of our soils with effective microbes, we can increase the moisture-holding capacity of certain soils in Western North America 5- to 6-fold, which means that whether we have drought or floods, we have a buffering capacity there to help our crops. And so we've had tremendous water and electrical demand rises during this last summer throughout Western North America as the heat waves hit. By building our soil moisture holding capacity, we don't have to demand as much water for our crops because the residual moisture is already stored in the soil, and therefore we don't have to pump water with precious fossil fuel during the peak times of demand, which makes it all the more costly. So again, I think my main message to people is watch what's happening in your own locality. Begin to foster innovations and adaptations and experiments, because each locality is going to need a different response to this. There's no formula. But there's a lot of fun in doing this experimentation, improvisation. I'm enjoying gardening and farming more than ever before, simply because I'm doing it with open eyes.
So where can people go to find out more about your new book and your projects?
Well, my website, www.garynabhan.com, has a wealth of material that supplements the book. And the book itself is available as an e-book and a printed copy from Chelsea Green Publishing. My website also tells where this fall and winter I'll be giving workshops and keynote talks at farmers' conferences throughout North America. I've talked in Calgary, Maine, Washington, and California recently, and there's more coming up, so you can check my calendar there. Finally, our Institute for the Environment at University of Arizona has an incredible wealth of materials predicting and suggesting valuable adaptations that people can make in their own lifestyle and food production in response to climate change. And the new book, edited by Greg Garfin of the Institute, assesses the impact of future climate change not only on Arizona or agriculture, but the entire western portion of our continent.
We have been talking with Gary Paul Nabhan, and that's spelled N-A-B-H-A-N. He's a researcher at the University of Arizona. His latest book is Growing Food in a Hotter, Drier Land, Lessons from Desert Farmers in Adapting to Climate Uncertainty, certainly one we need to know about. Get more information and the links for this interview in my show blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for caring about your world. Before we talk with Jerry Williams, who left the busy capital of America, let's look at the latest climate-on-steroids rainfall event in Boulder, Colorado. Extreme rainfall events are popping up all over the world, as I've been reporting. The latest was an astounding dump of water and severe flooding in Boulder, Colorado, and places north. Here is a report from the Weather Underground weather historian, Christopher Burt, published September 12th. Quote, an all-time 24-hour record rainfall of 9.08 inches, almost double the previous record, has deluged the city of Boulder, Colorado, resulting in widespread flash flooding and the deaths of at least three people so far. 12.27 inches has accumulated since Monday 5 p.m. on September the 9th. Needless to say, these are the numbers that surpass most tropical storm events. Other locations in the Boulder and Rocky Mountain Front Range have picked up over 11 inches of precipitation in just the past 24 hours. According to the Western Regional Climate Center's historical data set, Boulder's former 24-hour precipitation record was 4.79 inches on July 31, 1919. The September record was 3.5 inches on September 4, 1909. Records began in October 1893, with some months missing.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We just have time for a quick check-in with a favorite Radio EcoShock guest, Carolyn Baker from Speaking Truth to Power. She is based in Boulder, Colorado. Carolyn, you're right at ground zero for this extreme rainfall event that happened. What was it like in Boulder during the emergency?
Well, where I was, I'm on fairly high ground, so it was nothing but just a lot of pouring rain and no real flooding around right around me. But throughout the city, and particularly in the areas adjacent to the city and in canyon areas, it was terrible. And the loss of three lives and just incredible infrastructure damage. We're supposed to have a dry spell. We had one today, and we're supposed to have dryness tomorrow. And then so we hope that it will completely subside and we won't have any more flooding.
I read in one place 9 inches of rain, double the record for Colorado within a 24-hour period. That's not the usual weather.
That could be. I know for sure that we had from Monday through Thursday 14 inches during that period of time. We get an average of 11 per year. So that tells you something right there. This is really unprecedented. People are calling it the 500-year flood event. some mainstream media weather people are calling it biblical proportions. They're using words like antediluvian, and it's really quite amazing. You know, having a flood like this in Boulder, Colorado is equivalent to having a killer dust storm at 110 degrees in Anchorage, Alaska or something. It just doesn't happen.
And you have a great news service reporting climate change and economic scene and geopolitical stuff all over the world. But did you expect to be reporting right on an extreme weather event in your own yard?
No, I did not. Well, you know, to some extent, because I reported last year the extreme weather event of fires throughout Colorado that were just unbelievable and unprecedented. So, you know, fire is our big plague here. I did not expect to be reporting on a flood by any stretch.
Do you think this will get more people in Colorado wondering if there's something wrong with the climate?
Well, I certainly hope so. We don't have anybody talking about it just yet. We do have one article that was written earlier this year in the Daily Camera, our local newspaper, by a young man who says climate change will take us back to the dinosaurs. And you have to remember that we have three enormous climate research facilities here. We have NOAA, we have National Center for Atmospheric Research, and University Corporation for Atmospheric Research. So this is kind of ground zero for climate change research as well, and I'm sure we're going to be getting some reporting on that soon.
It kind of reminds me of the flooding that happened in Calgary, Canada, earlier this summer. The same, you know, huge rainfalls, runoff off the Rockies, and there you are, everybody going under.
Yeah. And the fact that we've had so many fires and there's just not the vegetation in some areas to hold back the water that we used to have.
Right. So have there been some mudslides? Are there things moving around?
Yeah, especially down in the Manitou Springs area, which is outside of Colorado Springs. And, you know, they had the terrible Waldo Canyon fire last year, and just nothing is left. And so they've been deluged with terrible floods down there and loss of life, even before what happened this week.
Well, even if we just get this every few years, big fires, big floods, it's going to change the landscape of the state.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. And that's not just Colorado, that's everywhere.
So what do you expect will happen over the coming weeks there in Boulder? Can you clean up from it? What's going to happen?
Well, we are cleaning up from it already. There's one little town north of here on the way to Estes Park. It's called Lyons, and it's built almost in a canyon. And they are totally cut off. And as we speak, choppers are going over. They've been going back and forth all day to evacuate people, to deliver supplies, to try to, you know, take care of those folks. We're really good around here about cleaning up. We did have the big Thompson flood back in 1976, so I'm sure that we'll get our legs back. But in the meantime, it's really done a number on our infrastructure and probably on the state budget, I'm sure. It's going to be a while, and hopefully we really will start talking much more about climate change in this state.
Well, I'm hoping to get an update from you when we talk again in October before you come to British Columbia. Why don't you tell people about your website and how they can get your new service?
Just visit www.carolynbaker.net, and up at the top of my website is a tab that says subscription or subscribe, and you can go there and learn more about the daily news digest that I publish every day, 7 days a week, unless I'm traveling, which includes not only news on all of the areas that Alex mentioned, but also options for how many people around the world are dealing with that hard news.
Yes, Carolyn is an expert in psychology and adapting to the stress of a collapsing climate and a collapsing economy, so I'm looking forward to that talk. Thank you so much, Carolyn. Bye for now.
You're welcome. Thank you, Alex.
When Radio EcoShock returns, Jerry Williams tells us about leaving the big city, and it's not easy.